If you thought climate change was divisive, then get ready for the bicycle helmet wars. It's bitter, polarised, and not in the least bit civil.
The whole argument's become one of faith more than science to some extent. Bicycle, bicycle, I want a
bicycle race. Australia stands virtually alone in the world, making it compulsory for cyclists to wear helmets. At stake, say those opposed to our helmet laws, is the very future of cycling as a viable mainstream transport option. Depending on who you believe, helmets either protect your head or they're an agent of the nanny state and have unwittingly killed off cycling.
Helmet laws made cycling dangerous. They frightened us. They bought into this whole argument of buying armour as such for when you do this extreme activity. It isn't a dangerous activity. It's an everyday activity. And I think helmet laws destroyed that. They killed off cycling.
Throw into this heady argument a good old scientific blue about whether helmets themselves can cause brain injuries, and you've got a highly emotional debate.
There's an advertisement which they tell people to strap it on your brain. That's the helmet, strap it on your brain. And they say that people increase their chances of escaping serious injury or death if they wear a helmet. So
you say that's wrong?
Yes. It's never been shown that wearing a helmet has saved a single life, I would say.
At its heart, this is a story about our cities, about who owns the roads. It's about civil liberties and obesity and a clean green future. Who would have thought all this could be wrapped up in 320 grams of styrofoam and plastic?
I mean, I'm just a simple bike rider, really. Yeah. So for me to look at the breadth of research that's out there and try and understand, you know, whether one set of research is done in a better way than another set of research is really difficult.
Hello, I'm Wendy Carlisle, and you're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. Australia stands virtually alone in the world in making it compulsory to wear a helmet. We did that back in 1990, when Bob Hawke made it a condition of road funding to the states and territories. Now the helmet sceptics say the laws have put people off cycling, and the argument goes, if helmets hadn't frightened people off, there would be more cyclists, exerting more pressure on government to build separate bikeways. Then it would be safer, and we wouldn't need helmets at all. Just like in Europe.
Est-ce que vous pensez que Vélib est une façon de protéger l'environnement?
Tout à fait. Absolument.
It's an argument that appears to be getting traction all the way into Sydney Town Hall, where the pro-cycling Lord Mayor Clover Moore now says she wants a review of the helmet laws. Clover Moore declined an interview with Background Briefing. She sent this email.
There are mixed views coming from overseas cycling bodies about the wearing of cycle helmets, and so we need to look carefully at the evidence for and against helmets and see what is appropriate for Australian road conditions. I agree that now is the time to look closely at the issue.
And then she sent her city cycling planner to explain the position. Fiona Campbell.
Well, some people are saying that it's counterproductive. So let's look at it. Let's look
in what way?
In terms of encouraging cycling. So the city's certainly not looking at prohibiting helmet use. I mean, that would be foolish, no. But there's a distinction. It's whether helmets are good or not, and clearly they have definite benefits. And then the question is about whether compulsory helmet legislation is good or not. And we're saying, don't know.
Sydney cyclist Nell Schofield agrees that it's time to look at the helmet laws.
Well, look, I've spoken to a few people who work in cranial departments in hospitals as well, and they say, you've got to wear your helmet, you've got to wear your helmet. And I always wear my helmet, you know, when I'm going around the city, because it's a tricky old city to get around in. But I do think if we want to get more people on bikes, we've got to look at all these different restrictions on our freedom because, you know, basically bike riding is all about freedom.
All over Europe, In countries like Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany and Sweden, cycling is a mainstream transport option. Governments have spent millions of euros on separate bicycle infrastructure. Cars have been taxed, speed limits lowered, and children taught safer cycling in schools.
Okay. Now through the lights, they're red, right? You have to stop. Go up to the...
It's much safer to cycle in Europe than in Australia, and it's got nothing to do with helmet laws, because in Europe, hardly anyone wears a helmet. In Denmark, Copenhagen is the cycling capital, and one of cycling's most outspoken advocates is Michael Colville Andersen. He's also a helmet sceptic, and he says whenever helmet laws are proposed, they get shot down.
What we see here is that people are warning against even promoting helmets, and certainly every single country fights battles against legislation. It's not very, doesn't come onto the table very often, but once in a while some politician somewhere will put it to a vote, and it usually gets voted down. France and Spain and Italy have all defeated, and England in several different cases have all defeated helmet laws.
And the reason is simple. Australia is cited as the case study of what not to do.
Then they look at the, you know, the effects of helmet legislation, and this is where Australia is named, you know, constantly. Look, let's not do what they did in Australia. You know, they killed off their urban cycling culture. And so Australia is the great sort of boogeyman. We don't want that happening here.
In 1990, when Australia introduced helmet laws, cycling numbers did take a hit, and some say by as much as 30%. But nobody is really able to say what the long-term effect has been. That's because in recent years, cycling has undergone a renaissance. In Sydney's CBD by 30% and in Melbourne by similar amounts. And what makes cycling safe in Europe is not helmets, but massive investment in cycling infrastructure. In the Netherlands, for instance, the government has spent around 60 million euros each year for the last 15 years on cycling projects. In Germany, over €1 billion have been spent on bikeways. In Berlin alone, there are 860 kilometres of separate bike paths. In Copenhagen, where Michael Colville Andersen lives, there are 400 kilometres of separate bike paths.
There's nowhere on the planet that has encouraged cycling without building separated infrastructure that has seen any, you know, any massive rise in the number of cyclists. You know, people feel safe. Infrastructure makes them safe, but it also adds the all-important perception of safety. And statistically, they are safer, of course. And if you want to get your grandmother out on a bike to ride into the CBD, or mothers transporting their kids or fathers transporting their kids to kindergarten or school on bikes, then what you do is you make it safe.
In the post-war period, cycling fell. People wanted cars instead. So governments took road space away from cyclists and gave it to motorists.
And what happened in the Netherlands and in Denmark is that our urban planning took a paradigm shift in the 50s, where it started to revolve around the car and the post-war economic upturn. You know, people started buying cars, and we started thinking, right, we have to plan, do our urban planning around the automobile for the first time ever. And the direct result was that people stopped riding bicycles because, you know, they were sort of forced off the roads. We separated infrastructure that we had even back then and gave it to the cars. And what happened was a plummet in the number of cyclists all over Northern Europe.
In the 1970s, the oil crisis hit. It was a turning point in the revival of European cycling. In Copenhagen, tens of thousands of people took to their bicycles and demanded attention. From where government sat, it made a lot of sense. Pro-bike policies made cities more livable and less congested. Cars got a red light and bikes got green.
You know, already in the 70s we were putting extra taxes on cars, and we now have like a massive tax on buying an automobile. The taxes altogether, environmental taxes, weight taxes, whatnot, it's like 180%. So cars are very expensive here, and this was put in place to discourage people from, you know, acquiring a car and to pay for the destructive capabilities of the car, you know, on the wear and tear on the roads and the traffic safety and whatnot. So it was a popular uprising, and that just sort of launched us backwards and forwards at the same time, you know, back to our roots and towards sort of a more modern vision of what kind of cities we wanted to live in.
Talk to any cyclist who's ridden in Europe and you get reports like these.
Germany, there are bicycle paths everywhere. They are clearly marked. People do not stray onto the bicycle path. It's a red path. If you go onto that path, you are treated like a jaywalker on the roads by the cyclists. They will ring their bells loudly. They will shout. They will drive fast at speed, which is what they should be doing because that's traffic. Some of them are reckless as well, but I do not see as many accidents or potential accidents as I see here.
As Sydney's Lord Mayor rolls out each new leg of her $80 million bikeways project, cycling enthusiasts gather at local pubs to celebrate. It's a social event as much as anything else, and as I rode up on my bike on a chilly Tuesday night, a group called Bike Sydney was operating a bicycle valet service.
When you're done, can you drop your card or your name off at the front? You can win a bike.
Thank you.
Over 100 cyclists have turned up tonight, and the helmet laws debate is one thing people are talking about. Although some cyclists, like Saskia, wish it would go away.
I'm going to hold you responsible.
So
I'm trying to stay out of the bloody helmet debate.
But it's a hard debate to stay out of in the world of cycling.
Oh, it's a very contentious subject, and people have a lot of strong opinions, and it's something that should be discussed, which is, it's good that it is being discussed finally.
Why is it so contentious, do you think?
Oh, look, I don't know. I think it's fear. I think people don't know any different. I mean, I'm from Europe, so I'm used to that being the norm, not having a helmet. But, I mean, the bottom line is it should be freedom of choice. It shouldn't be something that is imposed. And if people are sensible and they ride well, depending on the bicycles, depending where you are, if there's proper infrastructure, there should be no problem. The problem that Sydney faces is, at the moment, there's not enough good infrastructure, so people don't feel safe.
And on the question, do helmets reduce the risk of injury, Saskia is not too sure.
There are a lot of statistics out there. I'm not completely au fait with them all. The statistics that I've read for Australia certainly is that since the laws came into place, there has been no difference in injury. But then, you know, you hear everybody's got a story. I mean, everybody you speak to, cyclist or non-cyclist, has a story of someone that would be dead if they hadn't worn a helmet. You hear it all the time, which is why I've stepped back from it. I think the only way to get the laws changed are for people to feel safer on the roads. And I think the more infrastructure there is, the more people feel safer cycling, the less they will see the need for helmets. But the way Sydney is now, I mean, if I was driving through the city in commuter hour and peak hour, I mean, I've just walked through it, it's insane, I would be wearing a helmet. And in Europe, it's very different, and we can't compare it to Europe because it's not the same.
For the helmet sceptics, the villain in this piece are the mandatory helmet laws. Earlier this year, Sue Abbott was pulled over by a country cop in Scone, New South Wales, for cycling without a helmet. She was fined $56. She thinks helmets were an easy option for governments not interested in cyclists.
Basically, from what I have gathered from over the last 20 years, it seems to me that helmets were very much a commercial reality and one that was easy for governments to actually not invest in that because they passed the cost over to the consumer rather than actually invest in proper cycling infrastructure and education for motorists how to drive around cyclists when we're all sharing the road together.
So she decided to appeal her conviction. The crux of her argument was that helmets can cause severe brain injury.
I have, in the reading that I've done, and I've done that extensively, discovered that there is an element that wearing a helmet, you might sustain an injury called diffuse axonal injury, which is the shaken baby syndrome type injury, brain injury. And that causes severe brain injury, or can cause severe brain injury. And that risk is there. It hasn't been ruled out.
The judge dismissed her appeal, but he did quash her conviction on the grounds she was otherwise a law-abiding citizen. From the bench of the East Maitland District Court, Judge Ellis was sufficiently impressed by Sue Abbott's argument about the possible dangers of helmets that he made this personal comment, read here from the transcript.
I can tell you that I have looked into this. I've had other cases, at least one other that I can recall from Parramatta, where a gentleman had a similar attitude in terms of the unsafeness of helmets. And, as I said, if I was at the moment deciding which side of the argument, and there are arguments, as you acknowledge, there are arguments for and against, I think I would come down on the side of the argument with you.
On the morning the Sydney Morning Herald reported the judge's remarks, Background Briefing was in the office of Associate Professor Andrew McIntosh, a specialist in the biomechanics of impact injuries at the School of Risk and Safety Sciences at the University of New South Wales. As he read through the story, he shook his head, amazed the judge could reach such a conclusion.
Well, because the judge has probably been given material by this advocacy group, that's all. The judge hasn't actually read the science or is unable to interpret it.
So what do you think the implications are of that?
Well, I think it'll make people just decide not to wear a helmet if they don't want to wear one, on the expectation that they won't be convicted.
She told the court, according to this, that a helmet can increase angular acceleration
it doesn't,
to the head.
It doesn't do that, though. She would probably not be the person who could give evidence along those lines, but the evidence that she was given to give to the court isn't correct.
Andrew McIntosh says helmets actually reduce the angular acceleration forces on helmets, which in turn further reduces diffuse axonal brain injuries.
They're unusual in cyclists. They tend to be, say, motorcyclists might happen when they're riding and crash at very high speed, some motor vehicle occupants in high speed collisions. It's unusual for cyclists to have these injuries unless they're hit by a vehicle at high speed, for example. So angular acceleration is an issue in causation of brain injury. It is actually reduced by wearing a helmet. So when I did my PhD, I looked at the pedal cycle crashes, pedal cycle helmet performance, and also the tolerance of the human head to impact. And I found that with padded impacts to the head, that the angular acceleration as well as the linear acceleration was reduced. So it does actually reduce the angular acceleration.
Andrew McIntosh is a member of the Standard Australia's Committee for Pedal Cycle Helmets and for Helmet Test Methods. And he says the evidence is clear that helmets do reduce head and brain injuries.
There's been a lot of studies done looking at, I guess, estimates of how much the helmets have reduced the risk of brain injury. And clearly there's a debate about how well those studies have been done. I think that the studies all have limitations, particularly these sort of larger studies and where people are sort of looking at different types of data and trying to pull it and analyse it. But the effect is somewhere between probably about 50% and 80% in that range.
He says the studies have limitations because they tend to be on cyclists who end up in hospital.
The studies tend to be studies based on hospital admission data. So, for example, if you or I were wearing a helmet and we were in a crash and we got a severe impact to the helmet or our head and we got up and walked away uninjured, we'd never be recorded in any of these studies.
The one piece of research, more than any other in recent times, that has ignited the helmet debate is from Associate Professor Chris Rissell from the School of Public Health at the University of New South Wales. And he cycled straight into the helmet laws war zone. His research suggests the reduction in brain injuries of cyclists has more to do with other road safety reforms, like drink driving laws. Background Briefing caught up with Chris Rissell as he jumped off his bike in downtown Sydney.
You're not wearing a helmet.
I'm not. As you know, the evidence for helmets is certainly under discussion and is potentially doubtful, so I think choice is a significant option here.
You haven't been pulled up by the cops today?
Not yet, but I'm happy to have that happen because I'd really like to challenge it in court the way Sue Abbott has, because I believe that's really the intelligent interpretation of the data.
Chris Rissell believes there's not enough evidence to support the case that helmets have reduced head injuries. His paper compares the ratio of cyclists' head and wrist injuries before and after the helmet laws were introduced. The idea is to see if head injuries have reduced over time. Chris Rissell says they have, but probably not because of helmet laws.
We looked at the ratio of head injuries to arm injuries from 1988 to 2008. And the curious phenomena we observed was that there had been a really big drop in the ratio of head injuries before the introduction of the legislation, after which it sort of levels out and has been fairly flat ever since. And so clearly something else must have happened which led to that reduction in head injuries prior to the introduction of the legislation. And once we started to look into this, it was clear that there were a whole range of road safety programs introduced through the 1980s, speed reduction campaigns, lots of media advertising, random breath testing, many different things that have actually contributed to improvements in head injury rates for all road users. So cars, drivers, pedestrians and cyclists all had improvements during that period. And so that's probably the most likely explanation rather than the helmet legislation.
Chris Rizzle also says that helmets can cause more severe types of brain injury.
And the way that the helmets actually work when they hit the ground or something like that is that it produces some sort of diffuse sort of impact which actually twists the head really quickly. So it causes a greater rate of brain injury, basically, and helmets don't help with that.
Well, Andrew McIntosh says that's not the case, that the helmets are highly protective of that kind of injury. He also points out that those kinds of injuries, a very small number of injuries of the total number of people who have head injuries.
Well, I'd seriously challenge that, actually, because I've got a paper here by Bill Kerner, who basically has looked into this theory of brain injury. And I think the way he describes it is that this theory, basically, of angular acceleration is really the main driver for brain injuries amongst cyclists. And therefore, I'd have to challenge what Andrew's saying.
Chris Rizzle thinks what needs to be done now is to conduct a trial, repeal the helmet laws in one place and see what happens.
So I have been saying that we should do a trial of a situation where, in a jurisdiction, we repeal the legislation and see what happens and actually assess whether there is a great improvement in increase in head injuries or not. So I don't fear the great increases in head injuries that might result if we were to repeal it, and I'm saying we should trial it in a place to see what actually happens and so look at the evidence for the different issues that people are concerned about.
See, one of the problems, I guess, with this kind of research is that you can't have a control group, because it would be difficult to get ethics approval, would it not, to run a study where you removed helmets from one group and let the other group use them, because potentially it could be highly dangerous for the other group.
Well, that's why you have ethics committees and you have trials to do this. There is sufficient grounds to suggest that helmets don't have the impact that they think we think they should for a trial to be conducted. We've got many other countries in the world that don't wear helmets and don't have head injury rates of any particular concern. So I think it's quite feasible to conduct such a trial in one place.
The main advocate of the theory that helmets don't protect from angular acceleration and therefore may cause severe brain injuries is Bill Kernow, a retired Canberra public servant. Bill Kernow says his theory is based on physics studies from the 1940s and also experimental research on monkeys.
It's been shown experimentally. Of course, you can't just experiment on people. So what they did, they experimented, scientists in America and the University of Glasgow in Scotland, experimented with monkeys and other animals, and they showed that the addition of a helmet to a head, the weight and so forth, could increase rotation. They established that rotation of the head is the main cause of severe brain injury.
But isn't the test of all this quite simple? And the science shows this, that if you have a bicycle crash and hit your head, the helmet will protect your head and brain. I mean, the studies show...
Not your brain. No, they don't. They don't. They claim to show this, but I have refuted them in my two papers, 2003 and 2005.
Bill Kernow says his research is being ignored because the helmet industry is worth a lot of money.
Money. It's all about money, because the helmets law is a bonanza for the helmet supplying industry, manufacturers and importers. It gives them a guaranteed market, which is worth millions and millions of dollars. Now, if the government said, oh, no, we can't guarantee the safety of helmets, that market would be lost. And you know, that's a great loss to the industry.
Background Briefing is not in a position to go into the details of the science. We can only point you to what's being said in the peer-reviewed literature. The Cochrane Collaboration was established in 1993 as an international network of researchers, advocates, patients and healthcare providers. Its aim is to inform evidence-based policy making and is widely respected as the gold standard summarising the best evidence-based science. On the question of bicycle helmets, the most recent Cochrane review of 2007 and endorsed again last year is that bicycle helmets reduce the risk of head and brain injury by as much as 88%. Background Briefing will post a link to this on our website, as well as the other scientific articles discussed in this program. But the heat of the debate is causing many cyclists to question the received wisdom that helmets protect. Elena Gardner is president of Bike Sydney, a cyclist advocacy group, and they've decided to poll their members.
Well, it's a fairly topical issue at the moment, and at the moment we're really not sure what our members think. So there's lots of vocal people out there with some, you know, lots of different ideas about the mandatory helmet legislation. And so we're really just interested in finding out what our members think about the mandatory helmet legislation and what are some of the issues that are wrapped up in it.
Why is that? What's happened?
Well, I suppose Chris Rissell has put out some research that shows, or well, seems to indicate, that the mandatory helmet legislation hasn't had the effect that some people have expected it to have. And so that's brought up again the issue of people wanting to look at whether the mandatory helmet legislation is something that's useful to the community or not useful.
Why is it such a touchstone issue?
It's interesting, isn't it? I suppose because it comes down to the feelings of personal safety. I think also that being... it's really hard. I think bike riders are passionate people, generally. You know, you ride and you're full of energy, and I think some of that comes through in these arguments around helmet legislation. But why people are so... I think people become polarised in the argument very quickly. So what we see is that people take a view very quickly, but it very much comes down to personal experience. So people say, well, you know, I had an accident, and if I hadn't been wearing my helmet, I think I would be dead. That happened to a friend. So that personal experience plays on people's feelings very closely, and it's hard to get people to look at research and take that research on board away from that personal experience.
And then there's the personal experience women have with helmet hair. Nell Schofield.
One of the really interesting things I find is that I think it's about 75% of cyclists are male, and you've got a very small percentage of female cyclists, and one of the main reasons after death, fear of death, is helmet hair, that they don't ride a bicycle. You know, helmet hair is a big issue for ladies.
This is scientifically researched, of course.
It is. It's absolutely scientifically proven. One of the reasons that women aren't getting on bikes as much as men is because of their hairdos. So, you know, we need to look at that too. I mean, you know, women want to look good, and I understand that. You know, I want to look good too when I jump off my bike. Luckily, my hair is easily... styled, but you know, maybe we could look at having little booths for hairstyling around the city so girls can get off their bikes and address their helmet hair issues.
If you put to one side the issue of helmet hair, another argument advanced is that bicycle helmets make cycling look dangerous.
What's the root of your concern about helmets? Do you think they stop people riding?
Yes, I do. I do. And I don't think it's not because of the helmet hair. It's not because they're ugly. It's not because of the way they look. It is that it does dangerise cycling. It gives it a reputation of a dangerous sport. And cycling has has so many facets. It doesn't have to be dangerous. There's sports cycling, there's commuter cycling, there's recreational cycling. It's all hugely different. And to be told to wear a helmet for, tootling down the corner shop on your nice upright bicycle is ludicrous. But if you're in heavy traffic, use your brain and wear a helmet, sure. But it should be freedom of choice. And I think that's the crux of it.
There are now over 16 million cars on our roads. No one knows how many bikes. But it is known that cyclists are way overrepresented in road fatality statistics. And worse, their rates of serious injury are going up. This is according to the most recent figures from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. Stories like these are not hard to come by.
What do you think about bike helmet laws? Do you support them?
Yeah. I've been in an accident where I got a helmet, saved a guy's life.
So, what happened?
He got hit by a car. His head ricocheted into the chassis just above the driver's door, and the helmet took the impact. His femur went through his hip in the impact as well, so he probably wouldn't be alive if he didn't have a helmet on. So I have no problem with helmets.
And so why do you think there aren't as many people cycling in Australia, say, as in Denmark or Germany?
In Sydney, probably the topography, and the roads really weren't built for it. I've got to go.
Okay, thanks. On your bike then. Thank you.
And another time, a possum, late at night, I was riding down a hill quite fast and a possum ran underneath my front tyre and I hit the dirt again on the side of my head and I was knocked out, actually, yeah.
Even though you were wearing a helmet?
Yeah.
Did you go to hospital?
No, I didn't. I should have.
It's a busy night at the emergency department at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. Injured cyclists are a regular feature, and each week around three or four come in seriously injured.
We see it in the trauma bay, in the emergency department all the time that, patients come in having worn a helmet. We see the helmet and it's cracked, and we often say to the patients, look, that could have been your skull that came in broken. So I think it's supported by, the evidence on the ground as well.
Dr. Michael Dinn is the coordinator of the hospital's trauma centre and its staff specialist. A few months ago, he and his colleagues decided to examine whether cyclists who wore helmets fared better or worse than those who didn't. They started to crunch the numbers.
We looked at that data specifically and compared from the trauma registry over the last 2 years, patients who have worn a helmet and compared those who stated that they weren't wearing a helmet. And what we found was that the odds of having a serious head injury were around four times higher in those not wearing a helmet. So a serious head injury is something like a skull fracture or an intracranial bleed.
So how much uncertainty do you think there is in your findings?
To answer that, you'll have to go into the literature. Certainly, I think from what I've read in the literature, in the Cochrane collaboration in particular, that it is consistent with the data presented from the various other trauma studies, that the odds are reduced by fourfold. So it is certainly consistent with the wider, broader picture.
Do you see any evidence that helmets can increase the risk of head injury and brain injury?
Yeah, look, I've heard that argument before, and it is based on physics and the distribution of forces. Look, I think at the end of the day, the ultimate outcome is the patient and the incidence of severe brain injury from cycling-related incidents on the roads. And I think the evidence from our perspective is that helmet laws are working and that helmets do actually prevent serious brain injury.
Dr. Michael Dinn from RPA Hospital. You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. The next chapter of the bicycle helmet wars is now being waged in Melbourne, where in July, the Brumby government rolled out its eagerly awaited bicycle share scheme. The idea is to encourage people to use bicycles for short commuter hops around the city. It's the latest in the world's bike share schemes, already up and running in Paris, London, Dublin, Montreal, and around 150 other cities around the world. But Melbourne's bike share scheme is a test case. For the first time ever, bike share is being asked to work under mandatory helmet laws. And while the Victorian government has stumped up for 600 new bicycles, you have to bring your own helmet, and it's left plenty of people unimpressed.
It is a bit counterproductive. For instance, in Melbourne, have a public bicycle rack system where you can rent a bicycle on the street. And there's a nice little symbol there that says, or sign that says, make sure you wear a helmet because it's safer. Where are the helmets? If I'm going to rent a bicycle on the street just while I'm passing by, I'm not likely to have a helmet in my back pocket.
The organisation managing the $5 million program for the government is the Motorists Association, the RACV. It's had a slow start in the bitterly cold Melbourne winter, and Background Briefing met up with spokesman Gordon Oakley at the bike station on Federation Square.
We've got 50 bike stations and 600 bikes in the system, and it's almost exclusively in the city of Melbourne, although we will have one or two bike stations in South Melbourne. And in terms of use, the average for July and for most of August is about 140 bike rides a day.
Out of 600 bikes.
That's right, 140 bike rides a day, and is a function of the fact that we've got around 440 subscribers at the moment, and we've had something like 2,800 other users get on a bike and ride them around Melbourne. It's been our coldest winter in 15 years, and it's been really wet, and that does affect people's propensity to get on a bike and ride around Melbourne.
A lot of people who are anti-bike helmet claim that the reason that the bike share is performing so poorly at the moment is because of the bike helmet laws.
Well, I think there are probably a couple of answers. We've certainly talked about the weather as one of the factors. I'm sure that the bike helmet issue has played a role in the take-up of bike share so far. I'm not sure if we would have double or three times as many users if one could just get on a bike and ride it without a helmet. So this issue has certainly been a lightning rod to those folk who think that helmets are draconian or evidence of a nanny state. So
do you think that would the RACV, if the bike share scheme, if the health of it doesn't improve, would you be considering looking at getting an exemption for bike share from helmet legislation?
No, that certainly wouldn't be RACV's position. I mean, it's interesting, I ride not just when I'm swanning around in the city, I ride socially and for leisure and to get to work a couple of days a week. And, you know, the number of people I talk to who say, well, I fell off and I hit my head and I broke my helmet, but I would never appear in a statistic. So those people, those medical experts who refer to statistics that say there's actually a negative or deleterious impact on bike usage by having helmet laws, I'm not sure if they have all the data available to them.
Yeah, we need helmets, but where is this helmet? I don't know.
You have to bring your own.
Ah, really? Oh, no, we don't have it, so yeah, it's not used for, I think, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
According to Melbourne's helmet sceptics, the helmet laws will be the death of their bike share. Nick Dow is a cycling enthusiast, and he thinks the laws will stall Melbourne's effort to be transformed into a cycling mecca. And he wants the laws repealed.
We're seeing the first baby steps towards making Melbourne a cycling city. You know, it's a question of will we catch the zeitgeist? You know, in Melbourne, the cycling culture is more of a road racing culture. People who go relatively long distances, pretty fast, they're not really popular amongst the rest of the population. The bike share scheme is a very different sort of riding. It's the sort of riding that will come about if we make Melbourne into a cycling city.
Okay, but is it too early to say that bike share is a failure? I mean, you know, it's only been going for a couple of months and yet you're already sort of giving its last rites.
Well, that's true. Let's wait and see what happens in summer. You'll probably get a few more tourist trips on it. But, you know, cycling does go up and down in Melbourne between winter and summer, but not that much. I mean, it might, at the most, it might double in summer. Well, they're claiming 120 trips a day here. If you double that, it's still next to nothing. It's not going to have the effect that a bicycle share scheme could have, and everywhere else in the world is having. I mean, you could see cycling's been growing in Melbourne gradually and more rapidly in recent years, despite a lack of infrastructure. You know, infrastructure is very important, but in fact, that's where the bike share scheme can seed it, because it seeds the demand, and then government sees the demand is there and it can confidently build the infrastructure. And the other point is that when you get a lot of bikes on the road, it becomes safer for everybody, because the cars see them, and well, these are government-sponsored bikes, they're just respectable. And it just changes the atmosphere and it changes the safety for cyclists.
Nick Dow's argument is that helmet laws simply reinforce the idea that cycling is dangerous.
Well, there's real safety and there's perceived safety. What stops people from riding is perceived safety, which is a lot more scary than the real safety. It's actually a lot safer than you think, and the statistics show that. But sure, infrastructure is the key, and we won't get the cycling revolution that we could get without the infrastructure. But the helmet laws are simply holding it back. They're making it harder to get the numbers which we need to encourage the government, and vice versa.
The bicycle helmet debate is complex, and for every argument that helmet laws kill the zeitgeist, there's others who point to what's really happening on the roads. Melbourne cyclist Zulfikar Albany.
We have, okay, about one bicycle lane that I can think of right now in the CBD here in Melbourne. Nobody cares about it. You can walk, you know, everybody walks on it. Cyclists don't even bother with it. In fact, you know, it's a sort of a, it's too dangerous to use the cycling track, right? And that's because nobody cares that that's actually there for cyclists to be safe and not be in danger on the roads.
Zulfikar, who's lived in Germany, London and Melbourne, says he's never seen so much aggression on the roads as here.
The relationship between cyclists and car drivers is bad because they egg each other on, you know, it's a sort of a self-perpetuating system. And I think that both cyclists and car drivers suffer from too much ego. They've got themselves into a war state. I know that's going to sound over-dramatised, but that's exactly how it is. There's a lot of aggression on the street. There's a lot of ego and aggression.
Can you describe it for me?
The aggression?
Yeah.
Well, it's just, you know, people presume that the other person is going to cut them off, is going to want to steal their space on the road. So you hear of people having their cycles, their bicycles knocked by vans, you know, while they're riding. People here in Melbourne certainly will cut you up from the wrong lane, will turn right from the wrong lane and then scream at you when you say, could you please try to drive a bit more safely, you know, in future.
Has that happened to you?
Yeah, that has happened to me, yeah. Somebody from the wrong lane, so it was illegal to start with, they cut me up. And when I told them that was dangerous and perhaps they could try to be safer, they basically told me to get lost and drove off at even a faster speed than they were driving originally. So it doesn't make you feel very confident, you know.
Have you ever thought about reporting that to the police?
I have thought about that, and most days I make mental notes of car number plates and keep them in my mind for about 3 days, at which point life takes over again, because the one time that I did report something to police, I was cycling along and a car, again, was driving up on Swanston Street. And Swanston Street, you're not allowed to drive up unless you're a taxi, a bus or a bicycle. And I was spat at and abused, you know, verbally abused, you know. I reported this and, of course, nothing happened. Nothing happened.
Bicycles Victoria is Australia's largest cycling organisation. And spokesman Gary Brennan says it's too early to say that helmet laws have killed Melbourne's bike share.
I think the question is still open. There's no doubt that...
But helmets are obviously a factor, aren't they?
Helmets have got to be a factor, and I think No one would sensibly question that. The only thing up for debate is how much of a factor helmets will be.
And while Melbourne's appears to be the world's latest bike share scheme, not all schemes have been a success or accident-free. According to Gary Brennan, what counts is scale.
It's not correct to say that every bike scheme has been a raging success. I mean, the one in Belgium is a classic case study of one that didn't work, and helmets were not a factor in its failure. So some of these schemes around the world have failed in environments where there were no compulsory helmets. The ragingly successful schemes have been the big, dense ones. So there have been enough schemes rolled out around the world now that we know what makes them a success. And scale is the single biggest factor. The bikes have got to be ubiquitous, and they've got to be close together. So you need a dense city. And I think that what we have in Melbourne, an even bigger factor than helmets, is going to be our scale and density of our cities. And it'll be the same in Brisbane. Now, the Brisbane scheme is much bigger than the Melbourne one. The Melbourne one is only 600 bikes. The successful schemes that have been rolled out around the world have all been in the thousands of bikes.
And while cyclists wait patiently for governments to kick in more money, Zulfikar Albany's message is clear. If motorists and cyclists are going to share the road, then they need to share the love.
I just think that there are a lot of people who don't care. And that's the problem. That's also the ego thing. You have to change attitudes. And in a country that has this amazing history of public awareness, advertising for, you know, drink driving, violence towards women, we ought to be doing this now as well. You know, care for your fellow people. And that means that while the system is imperfect, the road system certainly here in Melbourne is really flawed fundamentally, you need to care for other people.
So you'd be running a campaign about behaving better on the roads, would you? What would the pitch be? Do the Gruen transfer for me.
The Gruen transfer? Yeah. What would the pitch be? Care for people. It's not bad to be hippie sometimes. And I was never a hippie. I was always more of a punk. But you must care for people. You must.
Coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness, technical operator Jenny Parsonage, research Anna Whitfeld. Background Briefing's executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. If you'd like to comment on this program, you can find a link on the Background Briefing webpage. I'm Wendy Carlisle, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.